Guest today in the studio, Sue Schleifer of O Communications. Sue is a life coach, an educator, one who takes in, I think, life to the fullest. She's a learner. And recently, having penned her first book, author, and also writes just a great blog about a lot of things just in life. So welcome, Sue.
Thank you so much, Cheryl.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And that is one thing that, you know, it's interesting because you are a teacher, you know, an educator about a lot of things, whether it's how people deal with situations in life. But you are really one who learns. Is how, you know, that's what I have learned about you.
I think that would be an accurate assessment.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I want to back way up. Where did life start for you?
Well, I was born in Santa Barbara, California.
Yeah,
very fortunate to have been born there.
Beautiful part of the country.
Beautiful. It's got the ocean and mountains. And at the time that I grew up, kids could go out and explore.
Yeah.
And we rode our bikes, and we walked, and we hiked, and we're outdoors all the time.
Yeah. And you lived there till about what age?
I lived there till I went away to college.
Okay.
And I went to, I started at UC Berkeley. And then I ended up coming back to Santa Barbara for graduate school. And I was there for about 2 years.
Can we talk about what years you were at Berkeley?
I was at Berkeley 71
yeah, so, yeah, like in
to
the early
73.
70s.
I was there my first 2 years.
Because you would hear, you know, people who did not live there or grow up there. Of course, at that time, there was a lot coming out of that area in terms of music, ways of life, protests, people discovering new ways of communicating, new ways of being, really. Do you recall?
It was a very exciting time to be there.
Yeah.
I remember my first semester in my dorm. I was on the third floor looking out the window of my dorm room and watching a cat and mouse game between the police and protesters on the streets. And it was, you know, it was scary.
Yeah. Because you were about 18 then.
Exactly.
18, yeah.
And I didn't, you know, I wasn't totally aware of what all the issues at that time. And we had classes were canceled a couple times. And, you know, it was a great learning experience. And, you know, it was the tail end of the protests about the Vietnam War and Cambodia and all that. So.
Yeah. What do you think it was about that area that that those types of things occurred? And I mean, you know, it was international news of things that went on there. What do you think it was about that community that I don't know. I mean, you know, those protests were happening in a lot of other things, but in a lot of other places. And it wasn't so much even just the protests, but it was, you know, people really wanting to talk about how they live and what they listen to musically and what they eat. I mean, there was so much, it seemed, coming.
Yeah. Well, of course, this is not my area of expertise,
yeah.
Cheryl. But
I mean, just being there as an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I think that it was a fairly diverse area. Not so much the university itself.
Yeah.
But just the area was quite diverse, and I mean, there were some really eloquent people who were attracted to being there, and there were really smart people at the university too. So, you know, Mario Savio, who, you know, gave up and got up on the car in Sproul Plaza and gave that impassioned speech that, you know, many of us have heard. If you haven't, I highly recommend that you rent the DVD or find it on Netflix. Berkeley in the 60s. It's a really excellent film about what was happening during that time. But, you know, it was the folk music, folk revival, you know, all of that was going on, and women's liberation and civil rights movement. I mean, it was just all coalescing.
And it was a place that allowed it to be comfortable for people to, you know, even though the police were involved and all that, it still was a place where people even sought out and went there to be a part of.
Yeah, they did.
Of those
mm-hmm.
movements, you
mm-hmm.
know. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what was it, do you think, in your family upbringing that because your life, and we're going to talk about the book that you have out, and it's going to come in and out of this conversation. But what do you think it was about your upbringing that instilled in you that adventurous spirit?
Well, that's a really good question, because my family, I mean, my parents at that time when I was growing up, we never traveled hardly at all as a
yeah.
family. I mean, maybe the furthest we went was Sequoia National Park, you
yeah.
know, which wasn't that far away. So now later in life, my parents traveled some, and especially my mom. But, you know, as I was growing up, that wasn't much of a part of our life. But I do think it had to do with the geography of where I lived
okay.
growing up in Santa Barbara. And I have some girlfriends that I grew up with. I've known them since elementary school, and we are still friends.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm going to see many of them later in the month in Santa Barbara.
And it's wonderful when you find that, isn't it?
Oh,
when that occurs
gosh.
In your life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we may not see each other maybe once a year, maybe once every 2 or 3 years. But when we're back together, it's just instantaneous friendship, and conversation just starts where it left off. Anyway, I'm going to see them all next month because I'm going to do a couple book readings in Santa Barbara
very
and
nice.
Ohio. Yeah, I'm really excited. Anyway, I mean, I grew up with this group of girls. We were all girls that just – we liked exploring. We were always out and about and coming up with creative ideas. And it wasn't just outdoor stuff. We did crafts. In high school, two other friends and I created a little catering company.
And you were given permission to do that, though. You know, however, if it was non-verbally, however that happened.
That's true. I think my parents were pretty permissive.
Yeah.
I was the third child.
Okay.
And I could pretty much do whatever I wanted. And I was a good kid, though. I mean,
sure.
I didn't abuse
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had a lot of freedom growing up.
Yeah. I want to talk just briefly right now about the book, though, because it is going to come in and out of this conversation a lot, because it does chronicle a number of things, a number of times, you know, in your life
mm-hmm.
and experiences you've had. But it's called The Key to the Castle, Zen and Travel Stories of Trust. I'm curious first, before we talk about that title, where and when or how did it come to you, I'm going to write a book?
Well.
And not overwhelm you to the point of, you know, because for some people that sounds very overwhelming. And you
right.
just don't do it.
Right. And it's not something that I had in my mind that I was going to do since I was young, or even, you know, since I was in my 30s or 40s. It was just I love to write, and I write mainly nonfiction. Well, actually, pretty much only nonfiction. And when I started my business, I started an e-newsletter. And so once a month for the last, gosh, how many years has it been? Maybe 5 or 6 years, I've been writing a story that starts my newsletter,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they're, you know, on all different topics, something I noticed, something I read, something I learned, and then I just kind of riff on it. And usually there's a personal element to it that then I try to generalize. Anyway, so I've been getting
I'm going to back you up for a second.
Okay.
It's great, the phrase you just used that you generally only hear musicians use. You said it, then I riffed on it.
Oh.
That was a great phrase.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Because of that's a common I think a style that happens, though, with certain kinds of writing, that you riff on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but
that's
just
okay.
was really taken
that's
by
okay.
that.
That's okay, and I kind
that.
Of digress from your question, too. But so I'd been doing these short pieces.
Yeah.
And I had never really thought about writing a complete book. And I talk about in the book that I took a big step and decided to do an 8-day silent meditation retreat. And while I was on the retreat was when I got the idea to write a book. It had never occurred to me before. And so it was during the retreat.
And how long ago was that?
The retreat was in 2000.
Yeah, because it was Wasn't all
nine.
That, yeah.
2009.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. Yeah. Yeah.
So I started writing the book in April of 2009, and I published it in May of 2013.
Yeah. And when, as you were writing it, why that process was going on, I'm curious how that process worked. Was it a daily thing? Was it an hour a week? Was it?
You know, it really varied.
Yeah.
I had some really great advice from a writing coach that I met with early on, actually. Just I only met with her once, but she suggested that to write at least 4 days a week, because then you never have more than one day off from writing, so you keep the momentum going.
And is there a time frame, like a length of time to write each day?
Well,
or just...
she didn't. You know, I think it really is individual.
Yeah.
So I tried to do that. Now, I was not always successful. Some days I would write, you know, most every day, and other times I would just take a break altogether.
Yeah.
Now, a lot happened between when I started the book and when I finished. So there were life going on that just distracted me from writing. But in some cases, some of the pauses really were when I was kind of thinking about it, and just sort of it was in the background.
Yeah.
You know, where do I want this to go, and how am I feeling about the structure of it, and that sort of thing. I wrote a lot of drafts.
And I'm curious, Sue, when you say, because first of all, I'm going to describe how I see the book.
Okay.
And my guess is that's going to be different for different people who are reading this book.
Probably from some of the feedback I've gotten from people,
yeah,
that it's been quite varied.
So I see it. It's autobiographical. However, it's not and I had made this note to myself, because when you read this, you find out experiences that you have had in life. But what I found myself was not as though, you know, I'm reading about Sue's experiences, but I'm not thinking about Sue. I'm thinking about it would trigger, and what's great is it's kind of like short stories, you know, different chapters that are a short story to itself, and then goes back and refers to something we might have read a bit earlier. But as you're reading and you're reading about these experiences you've had in life, which have been fabulous, I kept finding it triggering experiences I had had that, of course, were nothing like this. But because of what you did in some of these writings was you would ask questions and not answer them. You would ask a question about something like, well, now why did that happen? But then there wasn't the answer that you came up with. So I found it leaving the reader the opportunity to have your own thoughts about, well, why did that happen with her and that? Mm-hmm. And then it would trigger something in my life, or that I've heard other friends talk about, that weren't necessarily the same kind of experience, but brought about the same maybe kind of questions or emotions. So it was this great autobiographical book, but I didn't come out of it, you know, like you would read about, let's see, you know, a political figure that you read an autobiography on, you
yeah.
know?
Uh-huh.
It wasn't that. It really got you thinking about life and about how you handle things and how you think about things. And I found myself questioning myself sometimes during it, like, oh, wow, she really had that figured out. I don't know if I could have figured that out, you know, mm-hmm. and then questioning my abilities to – but. It was, and I don't know if it, I hope it's making sense what I'm saying, but it was a fabulous, fabulous book.
Thank you so much.
About the strength of spirit is a big thing that came through it for me.
Uh huh. Well, I'm really glad you picked up on the questions.
Yeah.
Because the book sort of alternates chapters between experiences that I've had in travel around the world. A lot of them when I was a lot younger in the 80s and 90s, and then alternates with chapters about learning about mindfulness and meditation and experiences that I had in that and questions that came up for me. And so I think about it as internal and external journeys.
Sure.
And so a part of Zen, which is my main training in meditation, is asking questions, big questions.
Yeah.
What am I?
Yeah.
What is this? Who am I? What's going on here? What do I notice? So I tried to echo those questions as I told the travel stories too. So the fact that you picked that up makes me very happy.
Well, and I also like that piece though, that the answer was not provided. You know, or that you did an attempt to, I mean, you know, there's some things in there, but it's not like you then attempted to respond to that question right then and there.
Exactly.
There were times just
exactly.
Left, it was just
because,
left open.
Yeah. I mean, we all have to make our own discoveries.
Yeah.
And and it's similar to what I do in coaching.
Yeah.
You know, we ask questions and we explore things.
Yeah.
And through that exploration comes the learning, comes maybe an aha moment. And I mean, I find that whole process for myself when I write, you know, some of this that I was writing about took place a long time ago. And through writing, it was like an opportunity to re-look at it and re-experience it and kind of ask myself, well, what did I learn? Did I learn anything from this?
Yeah,
or, you know, what did go on? And usually it's just leads to more questions.
Exactly. Which is okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so let's back up for folks that that don't know about this book and haven't read it. Let's give them a little background on what it is about and the stories, what they, you know, in your life. And maybe we can go back to talking about when you started working, you know, with the travel company, how all that came in.
Okay. So I started working for Backroads, the active travel company. Their headquarters are in Berkeley, California. It kind of by accident. And I had gone on a trip. I had gone on one of their cheapest trips. They're very expensive trips. They're like luxury vacations, adventure travel, active travel vacations around the world. They do bicycling and hiking and multisport. At the time they were called, that I started, they were called Backroads Bicycle Touring. And I had gotten into bicycling due to a housemate I had. And we would ride our bikes in the hills in Berkeley and Oakland and Walnut Creek and all over. And I decided that I wanted to go on one of the Backroads trips. And so I went on the Bryce Zion Grand Canyon camping trip in the fall. And it was a really great experience. It was hard. It was really hard. And I got in the van quite a bit because I wasn't, you know, well, there was one day like 100, over 100 miles through the desert. But anyway, it was a small group of people. We all really gelled and it was really fun. So on that trip, I don't know if this happens to you, but when I'm traveling, I oftentimes have some realizations about my life, my day-to-day
life. That's right.
And on that trip, I realized, you know what? It's time for me to leave my current job. It's just not a good match for me.
Well, travel is such a great way to get you away physically, mentally, I mean, all those, and to take things in a whole different way than, you know, that routine you get into
exactly.
many times day to day, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It kind of shakes us up a little
That's
bit.
That's right.
So I went back and I thought about what I wanted to do and I decided to quit. I stayed at this job a year, which I told myself I have to stay at least a year. And I quit without another job. I'd never really done that before. And, well, that's not entirely true. But anyway, I did it at that time. And I was working temporary assignments. And I thought, gosh, if I'm just working these funky temp jobs, I might as well see if I can get some temporary work for a company that I believe in.
Yeah, yeah.
So I called up Backroads, and they were very small at that point. And I talked to the office manager and told her, you know, I had been on a trip recently and I'm in between jobs and might they need some help? And she said, oh, well, could you come in for an interview this week? So I did. And, you know, I ended up getting a job. And I hadn't been there for more than a few months when the president, or he called himself the owner at that point, the owner of the company, Tom Hale, decided that he wanted to have kind of a manager level, you know, so that he wasn't supervising everyone.
Sure.
Not that we were very big at that point. But he asked me if I wanted to manage the trip development department. And I had to think long and hard about it because I had a master's in counseling psychology. And I thought, if I take this job, and this is the way we think when we're younger.
Sure.
I see this all the time in my clients. If I take this job, I'll never be able to go back to counseling.
Yeah.
Well, it's really not true, but that was what I was thinking. So anyway, I thought about it. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go for it. So I told him yes. And that started a 9-year career with Backroads. Now, I worked there for, I think it was 4 years. And then I left because I just felt like it was time to do something different. And Backroads, like, had totally been my life. It's like it was the owner is, I would say, a type A. I don't know if he still is, but he was then. Entrepreneur, and we worked super hard, and we played really hard. Mm-hmm. So it was my social life and my work life, and I just felt like I needed a break from that. And I got a job back in a university. I worked at UC Berkeley for 3 years in the academic advising office as a director. And at the end of the third year, I got a call from Backroads. And it was another manager, a vice president then, and she wanted to have lunch with me. And she said, look, we'd like you to come back. And she told me, you know, things are different and, you know, we'd give you a vice president job and the pay is so much better and the working hours are a little more reasonable and Tom's calmed down and, you know, yeah, you know, all those things, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to think, oh, my God, now what do I do now? You know, so anyway – obviously, I went back and I worked there another 5 years. And it was, you know, it was a tremendous experience. I mean, I traveled all over the world.
You know, before you go, because one of the things that was great in here was when you, I think it was after you went back or maybe during the first time you were there, where all of a sudden you kind of just got thrown into leading a trip.
Yeah.
And had not done that before, which is a whole different thing than doing a lot of the administrative.
Exactly.
Or being a participant.
Right. You know? Exactly. No, that happened pretty much right after I started working there.
Okay.
And you know, I have to put in a little addendum here because what I write about in the book, and it was the early days of Backroads, and they don't do things like this anymore. So I actually asked Tom if he would read the book, and he said he was a little scared to read it because it's, you know, all these stories about the old days.
Sure,
and,
sure.
And you know, they're just a much more sophisticated company now. And, you know, some of the stories I tell would never happen today, like throwing someone into leading a trip that hadn't been properly trained
and,
you know, hadn't been vetted by the whole, you know, leadership
process. But what do you think that experience brought to your life?
Well, I never saw myself as a leader.
Okay.
You know, so all of a sudden, here I was, a leader, you know. Now, a leader for a short period of time, but, you know, at that point in my life, that was pretty big. And I'm basically an introvert. And when you're in a position like that, you know, you're conversing over a fancy dinner with the guests who are from all walks of life, and well, mostly you know, mid to upper walks of life.
Yeah.
And they, you know, you're conversing with them, you're suggesting things that they might want to do on the trip, you know. So it was a very different life for me being put in that situation. And I, you know, you work very intensely with your co-leaders. And communication is so important and all those, you know, kinds of things that really leaders need to do.
Yeah.
You know, step up when they need to step up, you know when to give direction and when to step back.
And you know, it's interesting too, because a lot of what you were doing for that job, number one, physically draining, taxing and whatever term. Mm-hmm. But if you're an introvert and you're having to also switch on that other gear, that can be very, you know, emotionally, you know, mentally draining.
Yes, yes, definitely. Now, I wasn't leading trips all the time. I did it occasionally.
Yeah, but just to even do it that one time.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That first time, you know. And interesting, too, all the travels that you had through your experience with that company, like who knew really at that time it was going to end up in a book? You know, really.
Oh, I had no idea. No idea. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
One of my co-leaders is a woman named Susan Parker. And I always thought she
is
was going to be.
Is she Susie?
Yes.
In the book? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. I always thought she was going to be the one to write the book. Now, she has written and published a book, but it wasn't primarily about Backroads. Because she's a fabulous writer and she's very funny. And maybe one day she'll write her version.
Yeah.
But this book is not just about Backroads and not just about travels. I mean, it does profile some other travels that I've had in my life, as well as the internal journeys that I mentioned earlier. You know, some people go, well, how does this go together? How does it mesh? And that was the tricky part in writing this book. How do I make it work together? And, you know, of course, the reader will be the judge of that. But, I mean, I think I did it through the asking of questions, through looking back on these travel experiences, through the lens that I have now after having studied Zen.
Yeah.
I think that's how I bring it together.
Can you give, you know what we're going to do? Let's take a short break.
Okay.
And I know there's some music that,
yes.
that you brought. Do we want to listen to something from...
I think from one of my travels.
Okay.
Okay, let me just introduce this one. I think we'll listen to the Fado. And Fado is music from Portugal. And I, on one of my travels, actually, let me think about this. I was actually a guest. It was after I worked for the company. And one of the great things about working there is that the people in the office get to go on a trip a year. And because, the company wants you to know about these trips and what it's like. And so I had gone on the bicycle trip of Spain and Portugal. And I spent a few extra days in Portugal at the end of the trip. And I went out to hear music at a little restaurant that had this music called Fado, which I'd never heard before. And one of my favorite things to do whenever I travel around the world is to try to hear the music of that region. And so this is a little bit of Fado, and I believe we're going to hear Maritza.
All right.
Abraça este desejo que me invade. tatlı Gittim geçti
was Maritza. If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. We are listener supported, so we appreciate everybody who has supported us during our fundraising time and just throughout the year. And we do have a place, a safe, secure spot on with our website, too, that you can help us out and become a supporter of KRVS. And check out the website, too. Remember to like us on Facebook. And if you're just joining us, my guest today in the studio is author, writer, and educator Sue Schleifer. And we're talking about her book, The Key to the Castle, Zen and Travel Stories of Trust. And we just heard a bit of music from one of your travels.
Yes. Now, I didn't actually see Maritza. I saw, you know, someone
local. But the
local
style.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You, we've been talking, too, about how this book came together. And, you know, my other thought that I'm going to tell you about it, Sue, is that I am someone who's not visual, but it was really easy for me to feel like I was right there, and I could picture things that were happening. I know, you know, you and I were talking about there was an incident in here when you were by the Himalayas near there, and the vehicle broke down from some of the local people that were taking you from place to place. And you, the journey up before it broke down was on a very narrow road, correct, with a drop-off?
Mm-hmm.
And then just when you came over this part and there were the mountains, it's interesting because, boy, I was right there with you, you know, as you were doing that. And that style of writing, is that something that you really had to pay attention to, or does that naturally come?
It's really interesting that you say that because I'm a pretty kind of straightforward, clear writer. I don't use a lot of description. It's just not been my style. And when I had an earlier drafts and I showed it to a few people, and a couple people suggested to me, you need to add more description so that we can really see it. So I'm really pleased to hear you say that, because I guess it means, at least in that chapter, I did that.
Oh, throughout it, not just that chapter.
I definitely took that feedback to heart, and I went back and I really tried to add more description, but not as much as a lot of people write, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm glad that you got that picture, because that was what I was hoping was there, enough that people could make their own sort of visual image of what that might have looked like and felt like.
Well, and I think interesting, too, really, as we're talking now, because that was another incident where there was a question. There was a question on how should we handle this? You know, there was a group that was going to be traveling in the same vehicle that they were picking up to go down, and there was the question that came up amongst all of you: do we tell them that this vehicle they're getting on is not too with it?
Yeah, exactly. It was an ethical
dilemma
that we had. Some of us more than others, I suspect, but there were there were seven of us in our small group that we had taken this bus to go get to the start of our trek, And we had had some problems with the vehicle, and we felt lucky to get to our destination. And we didn't know it was going to return the next morning with another group of truckers and take them back to Kathmandu. And we didn't know whether to tell the group that, you know, there might be some problems with this vehicle. On the one hand, you know, if there were problems, that would be really awful.
Yeah.
You know? On the other hand, if, you know, we got there safely, and the driver even had to back down the hill when another bus wanted to pass, and we were fine. It had to do with the brakes. That's what we were concerned about. And we didn't want these folks to be worried on that night and their last night in the mountains and also on the trip down. And they could be stuck up there a long time because this was prior to, you know, phones.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about it as a group, and then individually we sort of made our own decisions. And I made the decision not to say anything. And I mean, really only in retrospect, writing this, you know, many, yeah, many, many years later, did I think to myself, oh, my God, what did I do?
Do you know if they made it down without any problems?
They did make it down with no problems.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And we know that because which we didn't know at the time, but our Sherpa guide had written a note and gave it to one of the trekkers to take back to his brother so he could make a complaint to the bus company owner. And he got the letter. So we know that's how we know it happened.
Yeah. As you're going through these stories in here, I want to talk a bit about, because you talked about going to Bali, and that was back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You recently went again. I mean, just recently went again.
Yes, I did.
And I'm curious about what you saw different, what you saw, you know, better, worse off. What were the changes? If there were changes, I don't know.
Oh,
I'm assuming there.
And lots of changes. I was in Bali in 1988 and 1989, two years in a row with Backroads. I was on the very first trip that Backroads did. It was a bicycling trip of Bali. And then the next year, I actually co-led the trip.
Okay.
That was one of those instances where I basically led it because I had been there the year before.
Can you describe what that area was like for you? What that kind of, you know, what it was like for you to be there for people who have never been there?
Talk about the late 80s. You know, even then, people would write about, oh, Bali's not what it was, you know, and people,
sure,
write that about every
yeah,
country. But Bali is an island, one of the Indonesian islands, and there's something like, I don't know, 10,000 Indonesian islands. The capital is in Jakarta, in Java, which is just to the west of Bali. It's a small island, and it's got mountains, it's got volcanoes, and then it's, you know, obviously it's an island, so it's got all these beautiful beaches. And it has lots and lots of rice terraces, at least it did.
Yeah.
And while it had in the late 80s some, you know, definite population centers, the capital Denpasar and some other places, it was really more small villages sort of that dotted the island. And actually the western part of the island wasn't developed at all. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. And I felt like it was an enchanted island due to the fact that the arts are so incredibly strong there.
Hmm.
Dance, Balinese dance,
yeah,
Balinese music, which is called gamelan, a painting, very, very important in certain villages.
And very much, but just a part of everyday-to-day life.
Well, definitely, yeah, a part of some people's lives.
Yeah.
But a lot of people in Bali have some art that they pursue. Not everybody,
but
a lot of people, wood carving. You know, those are just some of the, you know, the main forms of art that people partake in and practice. And it's a part of their religion. And the religion there is Hinduism, which is different from the rest of Indonesia, which is Muslim. And so it's a, and it's a different, slightly different Hinduism than you'd find in India.
Okay.
They have a lot of gods that they worship, and a lot of ritual that takes place during their daily life. And it's very much a part of people's lives. You see it. It's just very apparent you going down the street. And both times I was there in the late 80s, it was at a time when – a time of the year – and they have their own, actually, Balinese calendar – but when there were all kinds of festivals going on. So as we would ride our bikes from village to village, we would see the manifestation of them preparing for these festivals, making these you know, these gigantic papier-mâché figures that were going to be a part of a ceremony. Making offerings, which would be, you know, all different sizes, and, you know, might be fruit and flowers and rice balls all stacked up, and you'd see women in their beautiful sarongs with these baskets of the offerings on top of their head and walking very elegantly down the street with these, well, down the dirt road with these,
sure,
these offerings. Anyway, it was very magical. It just, something about it just totally resonated with me. And so I would talk about it quite a bit, and, you know, I told my husband Mark about it, and he'd never been – well, he'd never been to Asia. And so – but I hadn't been back. And this spring, he was looking to do a some sort of musical study during the part of the summer, and he found a program called Sudamani. And it's offered by a group of musicians and dancers in a small town near Ubud, which is sort of the art center of Bali. And they are professional performers as well as performers in their village for mm-hmm. the local temple and around the island. And then they also teach music and dance to the local children and adults. And 3 weeks out of the year, they have this summer institute where they invite students from around the world. And when I say students, I mean students of all ages, to come and learn about Balinese music and dance. So he said, I'd like to do this. You know, you want to go to Bali? And of course I said yes,
yeah.
You know. I said yes before I even asked him about it, you know. And I thought, well, gosh, I don't want to just sit around, so I guess I'll do dance. And I mean, Cheryl, it's the strangest thing, but I mean, I just jumped into it, doing dance 5 days a week from between 9 and 4. Now, we weren't dancing every minute of that, but outdoors, because life is outdoors in
yeah.
Bali, for 3 weeks. Now, I see myself as a dancer, but when was the last time I did that kind of intense dance?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, really, never. But,
yeah.
You know, I'd have to go back to high school.
Huh.
Okay. So it really didn't – I didn't even think about that until after I got home, actually, from Bali. But even while I was there, I'm going, wow, this is really hard. It was one of the most intense experiences I've ever had. And I just –
And there was other students from all over the world that came
mm-hmm,
for this.
Mm-hmm.
How large was the group?
Well, the dancing group was – well, it was quite small, actually. There were 8 of us who did dance, I think 7 for all 3 weeks and 8 for 2 weeks.
Uh-uh.
And they ranged in age – we ranged in age from early 20s to me.
Yeah.
And we were being taught by some of the best dancers on the island, dancers, choreographer, teachers. I mean, so I felt like, man, they are devoting their time to us. I better really step up my game here.
Wow.
And do this. And Cheryl, I actually performed. On the second week, I performed, and I didn't embarrass myself.
Wow.
And then after 2 weeks – I said.
And was it open like to public, like there being
oh, yeah.
an
it was,
audience?
Oh, yeah. That performance was in the Bali Banyar for that village, Pengosekan. And, yeah, there were people there.
Very nice.
People were actually watching. I mean, the fortunate thing for me, I kept telling myself, they're not looking at you, Sue. They're looking at the pretty 20-year-olds and this gorgeous man from Africa. So that gave me some comfort. And then I said, after the second week, I said, you know what? I better quit the dance before I injure myself. And I asked them if I could switch to gamelan. And
which is what?
That's the music. That's playing music.
Okay.
And they said yes, which was really nice of them because everybody else – and there were only, I think, 8 people doing gamelan. Although during the second week, just for 1 week, 15 students, music students from Australia – came to study for the second week.
Wow.
But anyway, so during the third week, I joined the group of 8, and they put me on the easiest instrument to learn, thank goodness, called the jagogan, and I had a blast.
Which is what?
It's a metallophone. It's an instrument. It's got bamboo or wood cylinders, you know, that go vertical, and then across the top are these metal plates. And there were 7 of these metal keys. And in any piece, we would just play 5 of them. And you have 2 mallets. And on that particular instrument, the mallets are pretty heavy. So during the first couple of days, I had to get used to holding these heavy mallets. And it hurt my wrist and my arm. And you play the mallet with – you play the note with the right hand. And then with the left hand, you dampen the key that you just played. So you're going back and forth.
Oh, interesting.
And the instruments are played in sets of 2. So there's 2 jagogans. So a Balinese musician would sitting on my right playing his jagogan and I was playing mine.
Do you play an instrument prior to going there?
I have dabbled in fiddle, you know,
okay.
throughout my adult life and never gotten beyond beginner.
Okay.
But anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, I mean, I love music and I have pretty good rhythm from dance.
Yeah.
So I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And, you know, I don't speak Balinese, and most of the musicians don't speak English, but we had so much communication going on.
Sure.
And some of the musicians, it was just these big smiles, and they were so encouraging. And I could watch, you know, what he was doing. And then the third week, I performed with the gamelan at a temple ceremony.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was a really incredible experience. But I don't think I really talked about what's the difference between now and before.
Yeah, but that's okay.
I think we should hear some gamelan.
Let's go out on it because we're getting short on time.
Okay,
so
good.
We'll go out on that.
Okay, good.
So which one should Cecil have ready just so we
– The Sudamani CD.
Okay.
Yeah,
and we'll go out on that because we're going to – otherwise we're going to be really short.
Okay. So the differences – going back this time, when we first arrived in Bali, this was in mid-June of this summer, and we're getting transport from the airport to Ubud, I was like in shock at the amount of traffic and mainly the amount of motorbikes. So it appears that everybody in Bali owns a motorbike. So for them, I'm sure they're thrilled.
Yeah,
one,
yeah.
that they have the income that they can afford a motorbike, and 2, that they have transport.
Yeah.
But you can imagine being on these narrow roads, and you know there aren't a lot of roads, although there are many more than there used to be, many more paved roads. These motorcycles go in and out of traffic, you know.
Sure.
And even the cars don't really pay attention to lanes, when there is more than one lane. So it's added an element of energy, you know, all those cars and vehicles and motorbikes and noise that there wasn't there before.
See, and I would think that would be a big difference, the noise.
Huge.
And the kind of noise
Huge.
That you're hearing.
And now we spent most of our time in the Ubud area, so I really can only comment about that area, but it's been built up so much. So
by locals or people moving there or you have a sense?
Well, both.
Yeah.
And by larger companies from Indonesia and especially Java and other, you know, I think Asian investment and people – you know, expatriates who build these beautiful homes.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But what we could mainly see was right near the road. And, you know, there's like 2 or 3 main roads in Ubud and in the vicinity. And there's just shop after shop after shop. It's like, how much shopping can – and it's all for the tourists. It's not for the locals for predominantly. And there are so many hotels and guest houses.
Hmm.
It's just – incredible.
People have discovered
it. And so the real reason that people, I think, well, I can't speak for other people, but for myself, you know, one of the reasons to go there other than the arts would be the peace and beauty. And so much of that seems to be disappearing.
Yeah.
And what we heard is that the rice fields, the land has gotten so valuable that and it's taxed based on its potential. So the farmers can't afford it. They can't afford to keep their rice fields. And so they sell, and what gets built are hotels. So many of the rice fields are being plowed under, at least in that area. So it's sad. On the other hand, I think the quality of life in terms of people having money to send their children to school, and I think health, those things, you know, are better for the Balinese. I think there's more opportunities. Everybody has a cell phone. They went from hardly anybody even having a phone, a landline. In the 80s, hardly anyone had phones. Now to everybody walking around with cell phones. So, you know, would I tell people to go to Bali? I think yes, if knowing what it's like. And also, you know, if you went for a particular purpose, you know, to study the music or the dance or to study painting or to make a documentary film or, you know, something like that. Or to study development. To study what happens when, you know, rice fields get plowed under. And
you see that in the States, too.
Absolutely.
You know?
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
And you
I mean, all the trade-offs. We see it here in Louisiana.
That's right. It's always, you know, having to look at those pros and cons, because out of some of the negative, there is positive things that come out of that, you know, depending on how each person individually looks at it.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the other thing is that the arts and the culture are still very strong.
Yeah.
So that even though there's been all this development, I think it seems as though the people are still very much living their spiritual life and involved in the arts, and the, you know, the government is very keen on keeping the arts alive because they realize that that's why people go there.
Sure.
Being a part of Sudamani, I mean, we really, what the thing that I love the most about it is that the associate director, Emiko Susilo, was like our cultural interpreter. So, you know, every day at lunch and during breaks of the dance, I could ask her questions about the things I was seeing because, you know, when you go there, you don't really know what's going on. So I got to ask her just all the questions about culture, about family life, about the rituals. And that was just so fascinating to me to have someone to kind of answer my questions.
I want to go back because we're just going to have a few minutes left. In your book, and it so relates to just a lot of the things that you've just been talking about, you know, and that whole spiritual side. And what I want to let people know, too, is that, you know, when you listen, if you don't know Sue, and when you listen to us talking today about, you know, what her adventures have been and still currently are, you know, so I look at you as, you know, you're somebody who's in shape, but you're not somebody who doesn't experience difficulty physically with some things. And that was something that also came through very strongly in the book in terms of that kind of strength of spirit. You know, when you were talking about some of the long meditation days, that there were some people who could just be on a cushion straight up and down. However, there were some people, including yourself, who needed to find ways to adapt to make that experience an okay experience. And I saw that as one of the important pieces of this book, is that, okay, she did it, man. I can do some of this stuff, or other people can. You know, when you think of something that's very trying on you physically or mentally, there are ways to adapt to, you know, to still experience what other people. I think that's an important piece of this book.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, and when you think about how, when you wrote this, what do you want people to take out of it? Did you have that thought even?
Well, I guess I would like them to, well, enjoy it, that, you know, that it's a good read. It's pretty easy to read, like you said. It's short chapters. And that maybe they just get some, you know, some questions that they might want to pose themselves occasionally, and find some ways to bring more peace and clarity into their own lives.
Yeah. And And you do get that out of here. I want to mention to people again, it's The Key to the Castle, Zen and Travel Stories of Trust, and written wonderfully by Sue Schleifer. And, you know, too, on the back of it, and of course I love that you have Daryl Bork, who did a piece about this book.
A quote, yeah.
Yeah, I just – very nice. And if people want to find out more about this book, they can go to oak-communications.com to find out more about Sue. You can also go to there. I know you can find out more about Sue through Facebook also and about this book. I just really want to thank you for coming on today.
Thank you, Cheryl. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. If you want, I think this is a book where you take whatever you want out of it. You know, like I said, I think everybody's going to have a different experience reading it. So, bravo. Let's look for the next one.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good week, everyone. We're going to listen to, now this is a cut, can you?
It's the group Sudamani. It's their CD that they produced. This is who we studied with in Bali, and it's their CD called Bamboo to Bronze. And we're going to be listening to the eighth cut under Humanity, the section Humanity.
All right. Have a good week, everyone. Thanks, Sue.